PFL, they might in fact be at the other end of the country. In that case, the security officers of, say, Kemerovo would send off inquiries to the security officers of Solikamsk, who would question the witnesses and send back their answers along with new inquiries, and you yourself would be questioned as a witness in some other case. True, it might take a year or two before your fate was resolved, but after all, the motherland was losing nothing in the process. You were out mining coal every day, and if one of your witnesses gave the wrong sort of testimony about you, or if none of your witnesses was alive, you had only yourself to blame, and you were sure to be entered in the documents as a traitor of the motherland. And the visiting military court would rubber stamp your tenor, and if, despite all their twisting things about, it appeared that you really hadn't worked for the Germans, and if, and this was the main point, you had not had the chance to see the Americans and English with your own eyes, to have been liberated from captivity by them instead of by us was a gravely aggravating circumstance, then the security officers would decide the degree of isolation in which you were to be held. Certain people were ordered to change their place of residence, which always breaks a person's ties with his environment and makes him more vulnerable. Others were valiantly offered the chance to go to work in the VOKHR, the Militarized Guard Service. In that situation, while nominally remaining free, a man lost all his personal freedom and was sent off to some isolated area. There was a third category. After a handshake, some were humanely permitted to return home, although even without aggravating circumstances, they deserved to be shot for having surrendered. But people in this category celebrated prematurely. Even before the former prisoner arrived home, his case had reached his home district through the secret channels of state security. These people remained eternally outsiders, and with the first mass arrests, like those of 1948 to 1949, they were immediately arrested for hostile propaganda or some other reason. I was imprisoned with people in that category too. Oh, if I'd only known. That was the refrain in the prison cells that spring. If I had only known that this was how I would be greeted, that they would deceive me so, that this would be my fate, would I have really returned to my motherland? Not for anything. I would have made my way to Switzerland, to France. I would have gone across the sea, across the ocean, across three oceans. In actual fact, even when POWs actually knew what would happen to them, they behaved in exactly the same way. Vasily Alexandrov was taken prisoner in Finland. He was sought out there by some elderly Petersburg merchant, who asked him his name and patronymic, and then said, "In 1917 I owed your grandfather a large debt, and I didn't have the chance to pay it. Here you are, take it." An old debt is a windfall. After the war, Alexandrov was accepted by the circle of Russian émigrés, and he got engaged to a girl there whom he came to love, and not just casually. To educate him, his future father-in-law gave him a bound set of Pravda, just as it was issued from 1918 to 1941, without any deletions or corrections. At the same time, he recounted to him more or less completely the history of the waves of arrests, as we have set it forth in Chapter 2, above. And nevertheless, Alexandrov abandoned his fiancée and his wealth, and returned to the USSR, where he was given, as one can easily guess, 10 years and disenfranchisement for 5 more. In 1953, he was happy to have managed to snag himself a job as foreman in a special camp. But the more thoughtful prisoners corrected them. They had made their mistake earlier. They were stupid to have dashed off to the front lines in 1941. It takes a fool to rush off to war. Right from the start, they should have gotten themselves set up in the rear, somewhere quiet. Those who did are heroes now. And it would have been an even surer thing just to desert. Almost certainly one's skin would be whole. They didn't get 10 years either, but 8 or 7. And they weren't excluded from any of the cushy jobs in camp. After all, a deserter was not regarded as an enemy or a traitor or a political prisoner. He was considered not a hostile factor, but a friendly one, a non-political offender, so to speak. That point of view aroused passionate argument and objections. The deserters had to spend all those years rotting in prison, and they would not be forgiven. But there would soon be an amnesty for everyone else. They would all be released. At that time, the principal advantage of being a deserter was still unknown. Those who had gotten in via 5810, snatched from their apartments or from the Red Army, often envied the rest. What the hell? For the very same money, in other words, for the same 10-year sentence, they could have seen so many interesting things, like those other fellows who had just about been everywhere. And here we are, about to croak in camp, without ever having seen anything beyond our own stinking stairs. Incidentally, those who were in on Article 5810 could hardly conceal their triumphant presentiment that they would be the first to be amnested. The only ones who did not sigh, "Oh, if I had only known," because they knew very well what they were doing, and the only ones who did not expect any mercy and did not expect an amnesty, were the Vlasov men. I had known about them and been perplexed about them long before our unexpected meeting on the board bunks of prison. First, there had been the leaflets, repeatedly soaked through, dried out and lost in the high grass, uncut for the third year, of the front-line strip near Orel. In December 1942, they had announced the creation in Smolensk of a Russian committee, which apparently claimed to be some sort of Russian government, and yet at the same time seemed not to be one. Evidently the Germans themselves had not yet made up their minds. For that reason, the communique seemed to be a hoax. There was a photograph of General Vlasov in the leaflets, and his biography was outlined. In the fuzzy photograph, his face looked well-fed and successful, like all our generals of the new stripe. They told me later that this wasn't so, that Vlasov's face was more like that of a Western general, high, thin, with horn-rimmed glasses. His biography testified to a penchant for success. He had begun in a peasant family, and 1937 had not broken his skyrocketing career. Nor was it ruined by his service as a military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek. The first and only disaster of his earlier life had occurred when his second shock army, after being encircled, was ineptly abandoned to die of starvation. But how much of that whole biography could be believed? As far as one can establish at this late date, Andrei Andreevich Vlasov, prevented by the revolution from completing his studies at the Nizhny Novgorod Orthodox Seminary, was drafted into the Red Army in 1919 and fought as an enlisted man. On the Southern Front, against Denikin and Rangel, he rose to be commander of a platoon, then of a company. In the 20s, he completed the Bistrel courses. He became a member of the Communist Party in 1930. In 1936, having attained the rank of regimental commander, he was sent to China as a military advisor. Evidently, he had no ties to the top military and party circles, and he therefore turned up naturally in that Stalinist second echelon of officers promoted to replace the purged commanders of armies, divisions, and brigades. From 1938 on, he commanded a division. And in 1940, when new, in other words old, officer ranks were created, he became a major general. From additional information, one can conclude that in that corps of newly made generals, many of whom were totally stupid and inexperienced, Vlasov was one of the most talented. His 99th Infantry Division, which he had instructed and trained from the summer of 1940 on, was not caught off balance by the German attack. On the contrary, while the rest of the army reeled backward, his division advanced, retook Przemysl, and held it for 6 days. Quickly skipping the rank of corps commander, in 1941 Lieutenant General Vlasov was in command of the 37th Army near Kiev. He made his way out of the enormous Kiev encirclement, and in December 1941, near Moscow, he commanded the 20th Army, whose successful Soviet counteroffensive for defense of the capital, the taking of Solnechnogorsk, was noted in the Sovinformbüro communique for December the 12th. And the list of generals mentioned there was as follows: Zhukov, Lelyushenko, Kuznetsov, Vlasov, Rokossovsky, Govorov. Thanks to the speed with which officers were promoted in those months, he became deputy commander of the Volkov Front under Meretskov and took over command of the Second Shock Army. On January the 7th, 1942, at the head of that army, He began a drive to break the Leningrad blockade, an attack across the Volkhov River to the northwest. This had been planned as a combined operation, a concerted push from several directions and from Leningrad itself. At scheduled intervals, the 54th, the 4th, and the 52nd armies were to take part in it also. But those three armies either did not advance because they were unready, or else came to a quick halt. At that time, we still didn't have the capacity to plan such complex combined operations, and more importantly, provide supplies for them. Vlasov's second shock army, however, was successful in its assault, and by February 1942 it was 46 miles deep inside the German lines. And from then on, the reckless Stalinist Supreme Command could find neither men nor ammunition to reinforce even those troops. That's the kind of reserves they had begun the offensive with. Leningrad, too, was left to die behind the blockade, having received no specific information from Novgorod. During March, the winter roads still held up. From April on, however, the entire swampy area through which the Second Army had advanced melted into mud, and there were no supply roads, and there was no help from the air. The army was without food, and at the same time Vlasov was refused permission to retreat. For 2 months they endured starvation and extermination. In the Butyrki, soldiers from that army told me how they had cut off the hoofs of dead and rotting horses and boiled the scrapings and eaten them. Then, on May the 14th, a German attack was launched from all sides against the encircled army. The only planes in the air, of course, were German. And only then, in mockery, were they given permission to pull back behind the Volkhov. They made several hopeless attempts to break through until the beginning of July. And so it was that Vlasov's second shock army perished, literally recapitulating the fate of Samsonov's Russian second army in World War I, having been just as insanely thrown into encirclement. Now this, of course, was treason to the motherland. This, of course, was vicious, self-obsessed betrayal. But it was Stalin's. Treason does not necessarily involve selling out for money. It can include ignorance and carelessness in the preparations for war, confusion and cowardice at its very start, the meaningless sacrifice of armies and corps solely for the sake of saving one's own marshal's uniform. Indeed, what more bitter treason is there on the part of a supreme commander-in-chief? Unlike Samsonov, Vlasov did not commit suicide. After his army had been wiped out, he wandered among the woods and swamps, and on July the 6th personally surrendered in the area of Siverskaya. He was taken to the German headquarters near Lützen in East Prussia, where they were holding several captured generals and a brigade political commissar, G.N. Zhilenkov, formerly a successful party official, and secretary of one of the Moscow District Party committees. These captives had already confessed their disagreement with the policy of the Stalin government, but they had no real leader. Vlasov became it. From his photograph, it was impossible to believe that he was an outstanding man or that for long years he had suffered profoundly for Russia. As for the leaflets reporting the creation of the ROA, the Russian Liberation Army, not only were they written in bad Russian, but they were imbued with an alien spirit that was clearly German, and moreover seemed little concerned with their presumed subject. Besides, and on the other hand, they contained crude boasting about the plentiful chow available, and the cheery mood of the soldiers. Somehow, one couldn't believe in that army, and if it really did exist, what kind of cheery mood could it be in? Only a German could lie like that. In reality, there was no Russian Liberation Army until almost the very end of the war. Both the name and the insignia devised for it were invented by a German of Russian origin, Captain Strickfeld, in the Ostpropaganda Abteilung. Although he held only a minor position, he had influence, and he tried to convince the Hitlerite leadership that a German-Russian alliance was essential, and that the Russians should be encouraged to collaborate with Germany. A vain undertaking for both sides. Each side wanted only to use and deceive the other. But in the given situation, the Germans had power. They were on top of the setup, and the Vlasov officers had only their fantasy, at the bottom of the abyss. There was no such army, but anti-Soviet formations made up of Soviet citizens were organized from the very start of the war. The first to support the Germans were the Lithuanians. In the 1 year we had been there, we had aroused their deep, angry hostility. And then the SS Galicia division was created from Ukrainian volunteers, and Estonian units afterward. In the fall of 1941, guard companies appeared in Byelorussia and a Tatar battalion in the Crimea. We ourselves had sowed the seeds of all this. Take, for example, our stupid 20-year policy of closing and destroying the Muslim mosques in the Crimea, and compare that with the policy of the far-sighted conqueror Catherine the Great, who contributed state funds for building and expanding the Crimean mosques. And the Hitlerites, when they arrived, were smart enough to present themselves as their defenders. Later, Caucasian detachments and Cossack armies, more than a cavalry corps, put in an appearance on the German side. In the first winter of the war, platoons and companies of Russian volunteers began to be formed. But the German command was very distrustful of these Russian units, and their master sergeants and lieutenants were Germans. Only their non-coms below master sergeant were Russian. They also used such German commands as Achtung, Halt, etc. More significant and entirely Russian were the following units: a brigade in Lokot in Bryansk province from November 1941, when a local teacher of engineering, K.P. Voskobojnikov, proclaimed the National Labour Party of Russia and issued a manifesto to the citizens of the nation, hoisting the flag of St. George. A unit in the Ozentorf settlement near Orsha, formed at the beginning of 1942 under the leadership of Russian émigrés — it must be said that only a small group of Russian émigrés joined this movement, and even they did not conceal their anti-German feelings, and allowed many crossovers, including a whole battalion, to the Soviet side, after which they were dropped by the Germans — and a unit formed by Gil in the summer of 1942 near Lublin. V.V. Gil, a Communist Party member, and even, it seems, a Jew, not only survived as a POW, but, with the help of other POWs, became the head of a camp near Suwalki, and offered to create a fighting alliance of Russian nationalists for the Germans. However, there was as yet no Russian Liberation Army in all of this, and no Vlasov. The companies under German command were put on the Russian front as an experiment, and the Russian units were sent against the Bryansk, Orsha, and Polish partisans. We soon discovered that there really were Russians fighting against us, and that they fought harder than any SS men. In July 1943, for example, near Orel, a platoon of Russians in German uniform defended Sobakinskaya Veselki. They fought with the desperation that might have been expected if they had built the place themselves. One of them was driven into a root cellar. They threw hand grenades in after him, and he fell silent. But they had no more than stuck their heads in than he let them have another volley from his automatic pistol. Only when they lobbed in an anti-tank grenade did they find out that, within the root cellar, he had another foxhole in which he had taken shelter from the infantry grenades. Just try to imagine the degree of shock, deafness, and hopelessness in which he had kept on fighting. They defended, for example, the unshakable Dnieper bridgehead south of Tursk. For 2 weeks we continued to fight there for a mere few hundred yards. The battles were fierce in December 1943, and so was the cold. Through many long days, both we and they went through the extreme trials of winter, fighting in winter camouflage cloaks that covered our overcoats and caps. Near Malye Kozlovichi, I was told, an interesting encounter took place. As the soldiers dashed back and forth among the pines, things got confused, and two soldiers lay down next to one another. No longer very accurately oriented, they both kept shooting at someone somewhere over there. Both had Soviet automatic pistols. They shared their cartridges, praised one another, and together swore at the grease freezing on their automatic pistols. Finally, their pistols stopped firing altogether, and they decided to take a break and light up. They pulled back their white hoods, and at the same instant each saw the other's cap, the eagle and the star. They jumped up. Their automatic pistols still refused to fire. Grabbing them by the barrel and swinging them like clubs, they began to go at each other. This, if you will, was not politics and not the motherland, but just sheer caveman distrust. If I take pity on him, he is going to kill me. In East Prussia, a trio of captured Vlasov men was being marched along the roadside a few steps away from me. At that moment, a T-34 tank thundered down the highway. Suddenly, one of the captives twisted around and dived underneath the tank. The tank veered, but the edge of its track crushed him nevertheless. The broken man lay writhing, bloody foam coming from his mouth. And one could certainly understand him. He preferred a soldier's death to being hanged in a dungeon. They had no choice. There was no other way for them to fight. They had no chance to find a way out, to safeguard their lives by some more cautious mode of fighting. If pure surrender was considered unforgivable treason to the motherland, then what about those who had taken up enemy arms? Our propaganda, in all its crudity, explained their conduct as, one, treason, was it biologically based, carried in the bloodstream, or two, cowardice, which it certainly was not. A coward tries to find a spot where things are easy, soft, safe. And men could be induced to enter the Wehrmacht's Vlasov detachments only in the last extremity, only at the limit of desperation, only out of inexhaustible hatred of the Soviet regime, only with total contempt for their own safety. For they knew they would never have the faintest glimpse of mercy. When we captured them, we shot them, as soon as the first intelligible Russian word came from their mouths. In Russian captivity, as in German captivity, the worst lot of all was reserved for the Russians. In general, this war revealed to us that the worst thing in the world was to be a Russian. I recall with shame an incident I observed during the liquidation, in other words, the plundering, of the Bobruisk encirclement, when I was walking along the highway among wrecked and overturned German automobiles, and a wealth of booty lay scattered everywhere. German cart horses wandered aimlessly in and out of a shallow depression, where wagons and automobiles that had gotten stuck were buried in the mud, and bonfires of booty were smoking away. Then I heard a cry for help. "Mr. Captain! Mr. Captain!" A prisoner on foot in German breeches was crying out to me in pure Russian. He was naked from the waist up, and his face, chest, shoulders, and back were all bloody, while a Sergeant Osobist, a security man, seated on a horse, drove him forward with a whip, pushing him with his horse. He kept lashing that naked back up and down with the whip, without letting him turn around, without letting him ask for help. He drove him along, beating and beating him, raising new crimson welts on his skin. And this was not one of the Punic Wars, nor a war between the Greeks and the Persians. Any officer possessing any authority in any army on earth ought to have stopped that senseless torture. In any army on earth, yes, but in ours? Given our fierce and uncompromising method of dividing mankind, if you are not with us, if you are not our own, etc., then you deserve nothing but contempt and annihilation. So I was afraid to defend the Vlasov men against the Osobist. I said nothing, and I did nothing. I passed him by as if I could not hear him, so that I myself would not be infected by that universally recognized plague. What if the Vlasov man was indeed some kind of supervillain? Or maybe the Osobist would think something was wrong with me, and then... Or, putting it more simply for anyone who knows anything about the situation in the Soviet army at that time, would that Osobist have paid any attention to an army captain? So the Osobist continued to lash the defenseless man brutally and drive him along like a beast. This picture will remain etched in my mind forever. This, after all, is almost a symbol of the archipelago. It ought to be on the jacket of this book. The Vlasov men had a presentiment of all this. They knew it ahead of time. Nevertheless, on the left sleeve of their German uniforms, they sewed the shield with the white, blue, red edging, the field of St. Andrew, and the letters ROA. These letters became even better known, although, as before, there was still no real Russian Liberation Army. The units were all scattered and kept subordinate to German orders, and the Vlasov generals had nothing to do but play cards in Dahlemdorf, near Berlin. By the middle of 1942, Vosko Bonyakov's brigade, which after his death was commanded by Kaminsky, numbered 5 infantry regiments of 2,500 to 3,000 men each, with attached artillery crews, a tank battalion consisting of 24 Soviet tanks, and an artillery battalion with 36 guns. The commanding officers were POW officers, and the rank and file was made up, in considerable part, of local Bryansk volunteers. This brigade was under orders to guard the area against partisans. In the summer of 1942, the brigade of Gil Blazewicz was transferred for the same purpose from Poland, where it had been notable for its cruelty toward Poles and Jews, to the area near Mogilev. At the beginning of 1943, its command refused to acknowledge Vlasov's authority, demanding that he explain why, in his stated program, there was no reference to the struggle against world Jewry and Jew-loving commissars. These were the very men, called the Rodionovites, because Gil had changed his name to Rodionov, who in August 1943, when Hitler's approaching defeat became apparent, changed their black flag with a silver skull to a red flag and proclaimed Soviet authority and a large partisan region in the northeast corner of Byelorussia. At that time, Soviet newspapers began to write about the partisan region, but without explaining its origins. Later on, all surviving Rodionovites were imprisoned. And whom did the Germans immediately throw in against the Rodionovites? The Kaminsky Brigade. That was in May 1944, and they also threw in 13 of their own divisions in an effort to liquidate the partisan region. That was the extent to which Germans understood all those tricolour cockades, St. George, and the Field of St. Andrew. The Russian and German languages were mutually untranslatable, inexpressible, uncorrelatable. Still worse, in October 1944, the Germans threw in Kaminsky's brigade, with its Muslim units, to suppress the Warsaw uprising. While one group of Russians sat traitorously dozing beyond the Vistula, watching the death of Warsaw through their binoculars, other Russians crushed the uprising. Hadn't the Poles had enough Russian villainy to bear in the 19th century without having to endure more of it in the 20th? For that matter, was that the last of it? Perhaps more is still to come. The career of the Ossentorf Battalion was apparently more straightforward. This consisted of about 600 soldiers and 200 officers, with an émigré command, I.K. Sakharov and Lambsdorff, Russian uniforms, and a white-blue-red flag. It was thrown in near Pskov. Then, reinforced to regimental strength, it was readied for a parachute drop on the line of Vologda Archangel, the idea being to make use of the nest of concentration camps in that area. Throughout 1943, Igor Sakharov managed to prevent his unit from being sent against the partisans, but then he was replaced, and the battalion was first disarmed and imprisoned in a camp, and then sent off to the Western Front. Then, in the fall of 1943, the Germans decided to send the Russian cannon fodder to the Atlantic Wall, and against the French and Italian resistance, having lost, forgotten, and not even tried to recall its original purpose. Those among the Vlasov men who had managed to retain some kind of political rationality or hope, thereupon lost both. The inhabitants of the occupied areas held them in contempt as German hirelings. So did the Germans, because of their Russian blood. Their pitiful little newspapers were worked over with a German censor's broadsword. Greater Germany and the Führer. And the Vlasov men had one way out of all that, to fight to the death, and when they were not fighting, to down vodka and more vodka. Foredoomed. That was their existence during all their years of war and alien lands, and there was no salvation for them from any direction. Hitler and those around him, even when they were retreating on every front and were staring their own destruction in the face, could still not overcome their intense distrust of wholly separate Russian units. They could not bring themselves to organize divisions that were entirely Russian, to allow even the shadow of a Russia that was not totally subject to them. Only in the crack of the final debacle in November 1944 was a belated theatrical production at last permitted in Prague. The creation of a Committee for the Liberation of the Peoples of Russia, combining all the different national groups and a manifesto, which, like everything that had preceded it, was neither fish nor fowl, since the concept of a Russia independent of Germany and Nazism was still not tolerated. Vlasov became chairman of the committee, and only in the fall of 1944 did they begin to form Vlasov divisions that were exclusively Russian. They were the first, based on the Kaminsky Brigade under S.K. Bunyachenko, the second, under Zverev, former military commandant of Kharkov, half the third, segments of the fourth, and Maltsev's Air Force detachment. Only four divisions were authorized. Probably the wise German political leaders had concluded that at this point the Russian workers in Germany, the Ostovtsi, would rush to take up arms. But the Red Army was already on the Vistula and the Danube, and ironically, as though to confirm the farsightedness of the very near-sighted Germans, those Vlasov divisions, in their first and last independent action, dealt a blow to the Germans themselves. In the general disaster, Vlasov gathered up his 2.5 divisions near Prague at the end of April, without coordinating his action with the German Supreme Command. It became known at this point that SS General Steiner was preparing to destroy the Czech capital, rather than surrender it intact, and Vlasov ordered his divisions to the aid of the Czech rebels. And at that point, all the hurt, bitterness, and anger against the Germans that had accumulated during 3 cruel and futile years in the breasts of the enslaved Russians was vented in the attack on the Germans. They were shoved out of Prague from an unexpected direction. Did all Czechs realize later which Russians had saved their city? Our own history is similarly distorted. We claim that Prague was saved by Soviet armies, although they couldn't have gotten there in time. Then the Vlasov army began to retreat toward Bavaria and the Americans. They were pinning all their hopes on the possibility of being useful to the Allies. In this way, their years of dangling in the German noose would finally become meaningful. But the Americans greeted them with a wall of armor and forced them to surrender to Soviet hands, as stipulated by the Yalta Conference. In Austria that May, Churchill perpetrated the same sort of act of a loyal ally, but out of our accustomed modesty, we did not publicize it. He turned over to the Soviet command the Cossack Corps of 90,000 men. This surrender was an act of double dealing consistent with the spirit of traditional English diplomacy. The heart of the matter was that the Cossacks were determined to fight to the death, or to cross the ocean all the way to Paraguay or Indochina if they had to. Anything rather than surrender alive. Therefore, the English proposed, first, that the Cossacks give up their arms on the pretext of replacing them with standardized weapons. Then the officers, without the enlisted men, were summoned to a supposed conference on the future of the army in the city of Judenburg, in the English occupation zone. But the English had secretly turned the city over to the Soviet armies the night before. 40 busloads of officers, all the way from commanders of companies, on up to General Krasnov himself, crossed a high viaduct and drove straight down into a semicircle of black mariahs, next to which stood convoy guards with lists in their hands. The road back was blocked by Soviet tanks. The officers didn't even have anything with which to shoot themselves or to stab themselves to death, since their weapons had been taken away. They jumped from the viaduct onto the paving stones below. Immediately afterward, and just as treacherously, the English turned over the rank-and-file soldiers by the trainload, pretending that they were on their way to receive new weapons from their commanders. In their own countries, Roosevelt and Churchill are honored as embodiments of statesmanlike wisdom. To us, in our Russian prison conversations, their consistent short-sightedness and stupidity stood out as astonishingly obvious. How could they, in their decline from 1941 to 1945, fail to secure any guarantees whatever of the independence of Eastern Europe? How could they give away broad regions of Saxony and Thuringia in exchange for the preposterous toy of a four-zone Berlin, their own future Achilles' heel? And what was the military or political sense in their surrendering to destruction at Stalin's hands, hundreds of thousands of armed Soviet citizens determined not to surrender? They say it was the price they paid for Stalin's agreeing to enter the war against Japan. With the atom bomb already in their hands, they paid Stalin for not refusing to occupy Manchuria, for strengthening Mao Tse-tung in China, and for giving Kim Il-sung control of half Korea. What bankruptcy of political thought! And when, subsequently, the Russians pushed out Mikolajczyk, when Benes and Masaryk came to their ends, when Berlin was blockaded, and Budapest flamed and fell silent, and Korea went up in smoke, and Britain's conservatives fled from Suez, could one really believe that those among them with the most accurate memories did not at least recall that episode of the Cossacks? Along with them, he also handed over many wagon loads of old people, women and children, who did not want to return to their native Cossack rivers. This great hero, monuments to whom will in time cover all England, ordered that they, too, be surrendered to their deaths. In addition to the hurriedly created Vlasov divisions, quite a few Russian subunits went right on turning sour in the depths of the German army, wearing standard German uniforms. They finished out the war on various sectors and in different ways. I myself fell under Vlasov fire a few days before my arrest. There were Russians in the East Prussian sack, which we had surrounded, and one night at the end of January their unit tried to break through our position to the west without artillery preparation, in silence. There was no firmly delineated front in any case, and they penetrated us in depth, catching my sound locator battery, which was out in front, in a pincers. I just barely managed to pull it back by the last remaining road. But then I went back for a piece of damaged equipment, and before dawn I watched as they suddenly rose from the snow where they'd dug in, wearing their winter camouflage cloaks, hurled themselves with a cheer on the battery of a 152mm gun battalion at Adlik-Schwenkitten, and knocked out 12 heavy cannon with hand grenades before they could fire a shot. Pursued by their tracer bullets, our last little group ran almost 2 miles in fresh snow to the bridge across the Pasarga River. And there they were stopped. Soon after that I was arrested, and now, on the eve of the victory parade, here we all were sitting together on the board bunks of the Butyrki. I took puffs from their cigarettes, and they took puffs from mine. And paired with one or another of them, I used to carry out the 6-bucket tin latrine barrel. Many of the Vlasov men, like the spies for hire, were young, born, say, between 1915 and 1922, that same young and unknown tribe, which hustling, bustling Lunacharsky had hurried to greet in the name of Pushkin. Most of them got into Vlasov military units through that same blind chance, which led their comrades in a neighbouring camp to get into the spy thing. It all depended on which recruiter had gone where. The recruiters had explained to them jeeringly, or rather it would have been jeering if it hadn't been the truth, "Stalin has renounced you. Stalin doesn't give a damn about you." Soviet law had outlawed them even before they outlawed themselves. So they signed up, some of them simply to get out of a death camp, others with the hope of going over to the partisans. And some of them did, and fought side by side with the partisans. But according to Stalin's rules, that didn't soften their sentences in the least. However, in the case of some, the shame of 1941, that stunning defeat after long, long years of braggadocio, ate at their hearts. Some believed that the primary guilt for those inhuman POW camps belonged to Stalin. They, too, wanted the chance to speak out about themselves and their awful experience, to affirm that they, too, were particles of Russia, and wanted to influence Russia's future, and not to be the puppets of other people's mistakes. But fate played them an even bitterer trick, and they became more abject pawns than before. The Germans, in their shallow stupidity and self-importance, allowed them only to die for the German Reich, but denied them the right to plan an independent destiny for Russia. And the Allies were 2,000 versts away, and anyway, what kind of allies would they indeed turn out to be? The term Vlasovite in our country has the same force as the word sewage. We feel we are dirtying our mouths merely by pronouncing it, and therefore no one dares utter a sentence with Vlasovite as its subject. But that is no way to write history. Now, a quarter of a century later, when most of them have perished in camps and those who have survived are living out their lives in the far north, I would like to issue a reminder, through these pages, that this was a phenomenon totally unheard of in all world history. That several hundred thousand young men, aged 20 to 30, took up arms against their fatherland as allies of its most evil enemy. This, in fact, is the number of Soviet citizens who were in the Wehrmacht in pre-Vlasov and Vlasov formations, and in the Cossack, Muslim, Baltic, and Ukrainian units and detachments. Perhaps there is something to ponder here. Who is more to blame, those youths or the grey fatherland? One cannot explain this treason biologically. It has to have had a social cause. Because, as the old proverb says, well-fed horses don't rampage. Then picture to yourself a field in which starved, neglected, crazed horses are rampaging back and forth. That same spring, many Russian émigrés were also in those cells. It was very like a dream, the resurrection of buried history. The weighty tomes on the Civil War had long since been completed, and their covers shut tight. The causes for which people fought in it had been decided. The chronology of its events had been set down in textbooks. The leaders of the White Movement were, it appeared, no longer our contemporaries on Earth, but mere ghosts of a past that had melted away. The Russian émigrés had been more cruelly dispersed than the tribes of Israel. And, in our Soviet imagination, if they were still dragging out their lives somewhere, it was as pianists in stinking little restaurants, as lackeys, laundresses, beggars, morphine and cocaine addicts, and virtual corpses. Right up to 1941, when the war came, it would have been impossible to find out from any hints in our newspapers, our lofty literature, our criticism of the arts, nor did our own well-fed masters of art and literature help us find out, that Russia abroad was a great spiritual world, that in it Russian philosophy was living and developing, that out there were philosophers like Bulgakov, Berdyaev, and Lossky, that Russian art had enchanted the world, that Rachmaninoff, Shalyapin, Benoit, Diaghilev, Pavlova, and the Don Cossack chorus of Yarov were out there, that profound studies of Dostoevsky were being undertaken, at a time when he was anathema in the Soviet Union, that the incredible writer Nabokov-Sirin also existed out there, that Bunin himself was still alive and had been writing for all these 20 years, that journals of the arts were being published, that theatrical works were being produced, that Russians from the same areas of Russia came together in groups where their mother tongue could be heard, and that émigré men had not given up marrying émigré women, who in turn presented them with children, which meant young people our own age. The picture of emigration presented in our country was so falsified that if one had conducted a mass survey to ask which side the Russian emigres were on in the Spanish Civil War, or else perhaps what side they were on in the Second World War, with one voice everyone would have replied, for Franco, for Hitler. Even now, people in our country do not know that many more white emigres fought on the Republican side in Spain, that both the Vlasov divisions and the Cossack Corps von Panwitz, the Krasnov Corps, were made up of Soviet citizens and not of émigrés. The émigrés did not support Hitler. They ostracized Merezhovsky and Gippius, who took Hitler's part, leaving them to alienated loneliness. There was a joke, except it wasn't a joke, to the effect that Denikin wanted to fight for the Soviet Union against Hitler, and that at one time Stalin planned to arrange his return to the motherland, not for military reasons, obviously, but as a symbol of national unity. During the German occupation of France, a horde of Russian émigrés, young and old, joined the resistance. And after the liberation of Paris, they swarmed to the Soviet embassy to apply for permission to return to the motherland. No matter what kind of Russia it was still Russia. That was their slogan, and that is how they proved they had not been lying previously about their love for her. Imprisoned in 1945 and 1946, they were almost happy that these prison bars and these jailers were their own, Russian. And they observed with surprise the Soviet boys scratching their heads and saying, "Why the hell did we come back? Wasn't there room enough for us in Europe?" But given that Stalinist logic which said that every Soviet person who had lived abroad had to be imprisoned in camp, how could the émigrés possibly escape the same lot? In the Balkans, Central Europe, Harbin, they were arrested as soon as the Soviet armies arrived. They were arrested in their apartments and on the street, just like Soviet citizens. For a while, state security arrested only men, and not all of them, only those who had in one way or another revealed a political bias. Later on, their families were transported to exile in Russia, but some were left where they were in Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia. In France, they were welcomed into Soviet citizenship with honors and flowers and sent back to the motherland in comfort. And only when they got to the USSR were they raked in. Things dragged out longer for the Shanghai émigrés. In 1945, Russian hands didn't reach that far. But a plenipotentiary from the Soviet government went to Shanghai and announced a decree of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet extending forgiveness to all émigrés. Well now, how could one refuse to believe that? The government certainly couldn't lie. Whether or not there actually was such a decree, it did not, in any case, tie the hands of the organs. The Shanghai Russians expressed their delight. They were told they could take with them as many possessions as they wanted and whatever they wanted. They went home with automobiles. The country could put them to good use. They were told they could settle wherever they wanted to in the Soviet Union and, of course, work at any profession or trade. They were transported from Shanghai in steamships. The fate of the passengers varied. On some of the ships, for some reason, they were given no food at all. They also suffered various fates after reaching the port of Nakhodka, which was, incidentally, one of the main transit centres of Gulag. Almost all of them were loaded into freight cars like prisoners, except that they had as yet no strict convoy and there were no police dogs. Some of them were actually delivered to inhabited places, to cities, and allowed to live there for 2 or 3 years. Others were delivered in trainloads straight to their camps and were dumped out somewhere off a high embankment into the forest beyond the Volga, together with their white pianos and their jardinières. In 1948 to 1949, the former Far Eastern émigrés who had until then managed to stay out of camps were scraped up to the last man. As a 9-year-old boy, I had read the small, dark blue books of V.V. Shulgin with more interest than I had read Jules Verne. At that time, they were sold openly in our bookstalls. His was a voice from a world that had disappeared with such finality that not even the most extravagant fantasy could have projected that invisible point in the soundless corridors of the big Lubyanka, where his steps would intersect my own before 20 years had passed. True, I would not meet the man himself until another 20 years had gone by. But I had time to study attentively many émigrés, old and young, in the spring of 1945. I underwent a medical examination with Captain Borshish and Colonel Mariushkin, and the pitiful sight of their naked, wrinkled, dark yellow bodies, not bodies any longer but mummies, has always remained before my eyes. They were arrested 5 minutes this side of the grave, so to speak, and brought to Moscow from several thousand miles away, and there in Moscow in 1945 an interrogation was proceeding in the most serious way on their struggle against Soviet power in 1919. We have become so used to the piling up of injustices during interrogation and trial that we have ceased drawing any distinctions of degree between them. This captain and this colonel were veteran officers of the Tsar's Russian army. They had both been over 40, and they had both served in the army for 20 years, when the telegraph brought them news that the Tsar had been overthrown in Petrograd. For 20 years they had served the Tsar according to their oath, and now, against their wills, for all we know, possibly muttering, "Beat it, scram," to themselves, they swore loyalty to the provisional government. After that, no one asked them to swear any more oaths because the whole army fell apart. They didn't like the new scheme of things, wherein soldiers tore shoulder boards off officers and killed them, and it was natural for them to join other officers to fight against it. And it was natural for the Red Army to fight against them and push them into the sea. But in a country in which at least the rudiments of jurisprudence exist, what basis was there for putting them on trial? And a quarter of a century later at that. They had lived as private persons all that time, Mariushkin up to the very moment of his arrest. Borshish, to be sure, had turned up in a Cossack wagon train in Austria, but in a transport with the old men and women, not in an armed unit. However, in 1945, in the very centre of Soviet jurisdiction, they were charged with actions directed toward the overthrow of the government of the Workers' and Peasants' Soviets, armed incursion into Soviet territory, in other words, not having immediately left Russia when Petrograd was declared Soviet, aiding the international bourgeoisie, which they had never seen even in their dreams. serving counter-revolutionary governments, that is, their own generals, to whom they had been subordinate all their lives. And all these sections, numbers 1, 2, 4, 13, of Article 58, were included in a criminal code adopted in 1926, that is, 6 to 7 years after the end of the Civil War. This was a classic and unconscionable example of the ex post facto application of a law. In addition, Article 2 of the Code specified that it applied only to citizens taken into custody on the territory of the Russian Republic. But state security's strong right arm had grabbed people who were in no wise Soviet citizens from all the countries of Europe and Asia. On this basis, no single African leader has any assurance that we will not, 10 years from now, promulgate a law in accordance with which we will put him on trial for what he does today. Yes, the Chinese, in fact, will promulgate precisely such laws. Just give them the chance to reach out that far. And we won't even bring up the question of statutes of limitations. This question was provided for very flexibly. No statutes of limitations applied to Article 58. Why stir up the past, indeed? Such statutes are invoked only in the case of our homegrown executioners, who have destroyed many, many more of their compatriots than did the whole Civil War. Mariushkin, at least, remembered everything clearly. He told us the details of being evacuated from Novorossiysk, but Borshch had already descended into second childhood and prattled on and on about celebrating Easter in the Lubyanka. He had eaten only half his bread ration during Palm Sunday week and Holy Week, and had set the rest of it aside, gradually replacing the stale pieces with fresh ones. Thus he had accumulated 7 full rations when it came time to break the Lenten fast, and he had feasted for the 3 days of Easter. I do not know what kind of white guards they were in the Civil War, either of them, whether they were among the exceptional few who hung every 10th worker without trial and whipped the peasants, or whether they were the other kind, the soldierly majority. The fact that they were being interrogated and sentenced in Moscow was no proof of anything, nor a matter of any consequence. But if, from that time on, they had lived for a quarter of a century, not as retired officers on pensions and with honour, but as homeless exiles, then how could anyone point to any moral basis for trying them? That is the kind of dialectic Anatole France mastered, but which we cannot seem to grasp. According to Anatole France, by the time it's today, yesterday's martyr is already in the wrong. In fact, from the first minute the red shirt covered his body, and vice versa. But our version is, if they rode me for 1 short year when I had just outgrown being a foal, then I am called a riding horse all my life, even though I have long since been used only as a cab horse. Colonel Konstantin Konstantinovich Yasevich was very different from these helpless émigré mummies. For him, clearly, the end of the Civil War had not ended the struggle against Bolshevism. As to how he continued to struggle, where and with what, he did not enlighten me. But the sense that he was still in the service remained with him in the cell itself. In the midst of all the chaotic concepts, the blurred and broken lines of vision in most of our heads, he had evidently a clear and exact view of everything around him. As a result of this reasoned point of view on life, his body, too, exhibited a steady strength, resiliency, and activity. He was certainly not less than 60. His head was totally bald, without a single hair. He had already survived his interrogation and was awaiting his sentence, like the rest of us. He could expect no help from anywhere, of course, but he kept his young, even, rosy skin. Among all of us in the cell, he alone did exercises every morning and washed himself at the faucet. The rest of us were trying not to squander the calories in our prison ration. He put his time to use, and whenever an aisle opened up between the rows of board bunks, he paced those 15 to 20 feet with a precise stride and a precise profile, crossing his arms over his chest and staring through the walls with clear, young eyes. And the difference between us and him was that we were all astonished at what was happening to us, while nothing around him contradicted his expectations, and precisely for that reason he was absolutely alone in the cell. A year later, I was able to appraise his conduct in prison. Once again, I was in the Butyrki. and in one of those 70 cells I met some young co-defendants of Yasevich, who had already been sentenced to 10 and 15 years. The sentences given everyone in their group were typed out on cigarette paper, and for some reason they had it in their possession. Yasevich was first on the list, and his sentence was to be shot. So that was what he saw, what he foresaw, through the wall with his still young eyes as he paced back and forth from the table to the door. But his unimpaired consciousness of the correctness of his path in life lent him extraordinary strength. Among the émigrés was one my own age, Igor Tronko. We became friends. Both of us were weak, dried out. Our skin was greyish-yellow on our bones. Why had we collapsed to such an extent? I think the main cause was spiritual confusion. Both of us were thin and on the tall side, and we were shaken by the gusts of summer wind in the Butyrki courtyard. We always walked side by side with the careful steps of old men, and discussed the parallels in our lives. He had been born in South Russia the same year as I. We were still nursing babes when fate stuck her hand into her well-worn purse and drew out a short straw for me and a long one for him. So it was that he rolled off across the sea, even though his white guard father was just a rank-and-file, unpropertied telegrapher. I found it interesting in the extreme to picture through his life all those compatriots of my generation who had landed outside Russia. They had grown up under good family supervision and in very modest, even meagre, circumstances. They were all very well brought up and, within the range of existing possibilities, well educated. They grew up without knowing fear or oppression, though the white organizations maintained a certain yoke of authority over them until they themselves grew strong. They grew up in such a way that the sins to which all European youth was subject in that period, a high crime rate, a frivolous attitude toward life, thoughtlessness, dissipation, did not touch them. That was because they grew up, so to speak, in the shadow of the indelible misfortune which had befallen their families. Whatever country they grew up in, they looked on Russia alone as their motherland. Their spiritual upbringing was based on Russian literature, all the more beloved because to them it was the beginning and end of their motherland, because for them their motherland did not exist as a primary geographical and physical fact. The contemporary printed word was much more generally accessible to them than to us, but they received Soviet books in conspicuously small quantities. And they felt this lack all the more keenly. It seemed to them chiefly responsible for their inability to understand what was most important, highest, and most beautiful in Soviet Russia. And the books they did receive presented a distortion, a lie, were incomplete. The picture they had of our real life was very, very faint, but their longing for their motherland was such that if we had called on them in 1941, they would all have joined the Red Army, and it would have been even sweeter for them to die than to survive. These young people from 25 to 27 already represented and firmly defended several points of view, in definite conflict with the opinions of the old generals and political leaders. Thus, Igor's group was called the Nepredreshentsi, the non-free judges. They declared that anyone who had not shared with the motherland the whole complex burden of the past decades had no right to decide anything about the future of Russia, nor even to presuppose anything, but should simply go and lend his strength to whatever the people might decide. We would often lie beside one another on the wooden bunks. I tried to understand his world as best I could, and our encounter revealed to me a concept confirmed by later encounters, that the outflow from Russia of a significant part of her spiritual forces, which occurred in the Civil War, had deprived us of a great and important stream of Russian culture. Everyone who really loves that culture will strive for the reunion of both streams, the one at home and the tributary abroad. Only then will our culture attain wholeness. Only then will it reveal its capacity for benign development. And I dream of living until that day. A human being is weak. Weak. In the end, that spring, even the most stubborn of us wanted forgiveness and were ready to give up a lot for just a little bit more life. An anecdote was current among us. What is your last word, accused? I beg you to send me wherever you please, just as long as it is under the Soviet government and the sun is there. No one was threatening to deprive us of the Soviet government, of course, just of the sun. No one wanted to be sent beyond the Arctic Circle to scurvy and malnutrition. For some reason, a legend about the Altai region in particular flourished in the cells. Those rare persons who had been there at one time or another, but especially those who had never been there, wove melodious dreams about the wonderful country of the Altai for their cellmates. It had the vast expanses of Siberia and a mild climate, rivers of honey flowing between banks of wheat, the steppe and mountains, herds of sheep, flocks of wildfowl, shoals of fish, populous, rich villages. Does not the prisoner's dream of the Altai simply continue the old peasant dream about it? The so-called lands of His Majesty's cabinet were in the Altai, and because of this the area was closed to colonization much longer than the rest of Siberia. But it was there that the peasants wanted most of all to settle, and where they actually settled. Is it not from this that the enduring legend has arisen? Oh, if only we could find a hiding place in that quiet. If only we could listen to the pure resounding of the cock crow in the unpolluted air, or stroke the good, serious face of a horse. Curses on you, all you great problems. Let someone else beat his head against you, someone more stupid. Oh, just to rest there from the interrogator's mother oaths and the monotonous unwinding of your whole life, from the crash of the prison locks, from the suffocating stuffiness of the cell. Only one life is allotted us, one small, short life, and we had been criminal enough to push ours in front of somebody's machine guns, or drag it with us, still unsullied, into the dirty rubbish heap of politics. There, in the Altai, it appeared, one could live in the lowest, darkest hut on the edge of the village next to the forest, and one could go into the woods, not for brushwood and not for mushrooms, but just to go for no reason and hug two tree trunks. Dear ones, you're all I need. And the spring itself sounded a summons to mercy. It was the spring that marked the ending of such an enormous war. We saw that millions of us prisoners were flowing past and knew that millions more would greet us in the camps. It just couldn't be that so many people were to remain in prison after the greatest victory in the world. It was just to frighten us that they were holding us for the time being, so that we might remember and take heed. Of course, there would soon be a total amnesty and all of us would be released. Someone even swore that he had read in a newspaper that Stalin, replying to some American correspondent, whose name I cannot remember, said that after the war there would be an amnesty the like of which the world had never seen. And one of the interrogators had actually said to someone else that there would soon be a general amnesty. These rumours were a help to the interrogators because they weakened the prisoner's will. The hell with him, let's sign, it isn't going to be for long anyway. But for mercy one must have wisdom. This has been a truth throughout our history, and will remain one for a long time to come. We did not heed the few sober minds among us who croaked out that never, in a whole quarter century, had there been an amnesty for political prisoners, and that there never would be one. Some cell expert among the stool pigeons leapt up with an answer. Yes, there was. In 1927, for the 10th anniversary of the revolution, all the prisons were emptied and white flags were flown on all of them. This astonishing vision of white flags on the prisons, why white, was particularly striking. Vyshinsky presents the figures. In the 1927 amnesty, 7.3% of the prisoners were amnestied. This is a credible figure, pretty poor for a 10th anniversary. Among the political prisoners, women with children were freed, and those who had only a few months left to serve. In the Verkhno-Uralsk prison isolator, for example, 12 out of the 200 prisoners there were released. But in the middle of it, they regretted even this wretched amnesty and began to block it. They delayed some releases, and some people who were freed were given a minus restriction instead of full freedom to go where they pleased. We brushed aside those wise individuals among us who explained that millions of us were imprisoned precisely because the war had ended. We were no longer needed at the front. We were dangerous in the rear. And were it not for us, not one brick would ever get laid at the remote construction project. We were too self-absorbed even to grasp Stalin's simple economic calculations, let alone his malice. Just who this year, after being demobilized, would want to leave his family and home and go off to the Kolyma, to Vorkuta, to Siberia, where there were neither roads nor houses? It was virtually the job of the State Planning Commission to assign to the MVD the number of workers required for plan fulfillment, and thus the number to be arrested. An amnesty, a broad and generous amnesty, was what we waited for and thirsted for. Somebody said that in England, prisoners were amnestied on the anniversary of the coronation. In other words, every year. Many politicals had been amnestied on the 300th anniversary of the Romanovs in 1912. Could it really be possible that now, after we had won a victory which would resound throughout our entire era and even longer, the Stalin government would be petty and vengeful, and would hang on to its resentment of every stumble and slip of each of its minuscule subjects? There is a simple truth which one can learn only through suffering. In war, not victories are blessed, but defeats. Governments need victories, and the people need defeats. Victory gives rise to the desire for more victories, but after a defeat it is freedom that men desire and usually attain. A people needs defeat, just as an individual needs suffering and misfortune. They compel a deepening of the inner life and generate a spiritual upsurge. The Poltava victory was a great misfortune for Russia. It resulted in 2 centuries of great strain and stress, ruin, the absence of freedom, and war again. The Poltava victory spelled salvation for the Swedes. Having lost the appetite for war, the Swedes became the most prosperous and the freest people in Europe. Perhaps only in the 20th century, if one is to believe the stories one hears, has their stagnating well-being led to moral indigestion. We are so used to taking pride in our victory over Napoleon that we leave out of account the fact that because of it, the emancipation of the serfs did not take place a half century sooner. Because of it, the strengthened monarchy destroyed the Decembrists. The French occupation was never a reality for Russia. But the Crimean War and the Japanese War and our war with Germany in the First World War, all those defeats brought us freedom and revolution. We believed in amnesty that spring. We weren't being at all original in this. Talking with old prisoners, one gradually discovers that this thirst for mercy and this faith in mercy is never absent within grey prison walls. For decades and decades, wave after wave of prisoners has thirsted for and believed in either an amnesty or a new code or a general review of cases. And the rumours about these things have always been supported by the organs with skilled caution. The prisoner's imagination sees the ardently awaited arrival of the Angel of Liberation in just about anything. The next anniversary of the October Revolution, Lenin's anniversaries, Victory Day, Red Army Day, Paris Commune Day. Every new session of the All-Russian Central Executive Committee, the VTSIK, the end of every 5-year plan. Every plenary session of the Supreme Court. And the wilder the arrests, the more Homeric and mind-boggling the scale of the waves of prisoners, the more they inspired not sober-mindedness, but faith in amnesty. All sources of light can to some degree be compared with the sun, and the sun cannot be compared with anything. So it is that all the expectations in the world can be compared with the expectation of amnesty, but the expectation of amnesty cannot be compared with anything else. In the spring of 1945, every newcomer to the cell was asked first of all what he had heard about an amnesty, and if 2 or 3 prisoners were taken from their cell with their things, the cell experts immediately compared cases and drew the conclusion that theirs were the least serious cases, and they had clearly been taken out to be released. It had begun. In the toilet and in the baths, the prisoners' post offices, our activists looked everywhere for signs and graffiti about the amnesty. And one day at the beginning of July, in the famous lavender vestibule of the Butyrki baths, we read the enormous prophecy written in soap on a glazed lavender slab far higher than a man's head, which meant that one man had stood on another's shoulders in order to write it in a place where it would take longer to erase. Hurrah! Amnesty on July the 17th! Indeed, the bastards were wrong by only one digit. For more details on the great Stalin amnesty of July the 7th, 1945, See Part 3, Chapter 6. What a celebration went on. After all, if they hadn't known for sure, they wouldn't have written it. Everything that beat, pulsed, circulated in the body came to a stop beneath the wave of happiness, the expectation that the doors were about to swing open. But for mercy, one must have wisdom. In the middle of July, the corridor jailer sent one old man from our cell to wash down the toilet, and while they were there, eye to eye, for he wouldn't have dared in the presence of witnesses, he looked sympathetically at the prisoner's grey head and asked, "What's your article, Father?" 58. The old man lit up. At home, three generations were mourning his arrest. "You're not included," sighed the jailer. "Nonsense," we decided in the cell. "Just an illiterate jailer." There was also a young man from Kiev in the cell, Valentin.